Chapter 11. This man was the ship's corporal, or constable, in the opposite watch from me, and was captain of those unfortunate ones called blacklist men, subjected to perform the scavenger work of the ship, and also to scour the brass, copper, and iron, where and whenever it was called for. In this work he appeared delighted to honor the king. The rattan in his hand looked to me like the same one that he used to switch about some of those unfortunate men. I have before narrated in part how the first lieutenant, Campbell, threatened me with an unmerciful whipping if I did not move to suit him wherever I was stationed, because I had attempted to swim away from the St. Salvador del Mondo a few days before I was introduced on board the Rodney, as I have before shown. After watching me for more than a year to execute his threat, he was one day told there was a pair of trousers between the main masthead and heel of the topmast. I acknowledged they were mine, for which offense he kept me in the blacklist for 6 months. We had about 2 hours in a week to scrub and wash clothes in salt water, sometimes a few quarts of fresh water, if one could get it before the 2 hours closed, and no clothes to be dried at any other time except our hammocks, when required to scrub them. Every morning in the warm season we were required to muster with clean frocks and trousers. If reported not clean, the penalty was the blacklist. If I could have obtained from the purser out of the slop chest the clothes I absolutely needed, I should never have been put to my wit's end as I was to avoid the blacklist. I had at different times stated to the officer of our division how destitute I was in comparison with others, and begged him to give me an order for clothing to muster in. In this I failed, and because my old clothes were too much worn to be decent, I suffered as I did. I never knew any other reason for thus requiring me, as it were, to make bricks without stubble or straw, than my first offense to swim away from their service. It was a government gain to serve clothes out to us, for they were charged to us at their own price and deducted out of our scanty allowance of wages. I had an opportunity to know that it was not because I lived in ignorance of my duty as many others did, for the same Mr. Campbell promoted me more than once to higher stations, and I was told that my wages were increased in proportion. This corporal never used his rattan on me, but the way he honored me then was to turn me out of my hammock, if I was so fortunate as to get into it after doing duty on deck from the midnight hour, and set me at work with the blacklist gang until it was time for me to take my station and my watch on deck again, and no more liberty for sleep until the night watch was set. In this way I sometimes got the privilege of about 5 hours of sleep below, and oftener but 4 hours out of the 24. I was well satisfied he could have favored me in this matter, if he pleased. But we obeyed, knowing well, if he reported us slack or disobedient, our task would have been made still harder and more degrading. And all this for attempting to dry a pair of trousers that my name might appear on the clean list? Without gratifying his curiosity as to who I was, I learned from him the whereabouts of many of the officers and crew, a great many of whom I felt a strong attachment for. I employed two sturdy-looking Irishmen to shovel our salt out of the salt scows into the ballast port, a hole in the ship's side. While progressing in their work, I saw them leaning over their salt shovels. Said I, "What's the matter?" "Matter enough, sir. Your men don't shovel it away as fast as we shovel it in." Some 7 or 8 men were shoveling it away from them into the ship's hole. Said I, "What is the matter, men? Are you not able to shovel the salt away as fast as these 2 men shovel it in?" They replied they were not. Said one of the Irishmen who was listening at the ballast port, "If we had as much meat to eat as you, then we would give you as much again salt." "Why," said one of my sailors, who seemed much troubled about this, "don't you have any meat?" "No," said they, "we have not had any this fortnight." "What do you eat then?" said the sailor. "Potatoes, sure," was the reply. My sailors were then living on all the varieties that good boarding houses afford in Liverpool. Many are of the opinion that meat imparts superior strength to the laboring class. Here, then, is one proof to the contrary. On account of prevailing westerly winds on our homeward passage, we came into the neighborhood of the Western Islands. Here we saw the towering peak of Pico mingling with the clouds. By our observations at noon, we learned that we were 80 miles north of it. By running toward it 60 miles, we should probably have discovered its base. We arrived safely in Alexandria, District of Columbia, in the fall of 1820. As no business offered for the ship, I returned to my family in New England, having been absent some 16 months. Early in the spring of 1821, I sailed again for Alexandria and took charge of the Talbot again to perform a voyage to South America. The bulk of our cargo was flour. My position was more responsible now than before, for the whole cargo as well as the ship was now confided to me for sales and returns. My compensation for services this voyage was more than doubled. My brother, F., was my chief mate. We cleared for Rio Janeiro in the Brazils. With a fair wind, a few hours' sail from Alexandria, we are passing ex-President Washington's plantation at Mount Vernon. Sailors say that it was customary with some commanders to lower their topmast sails as a token of respect when they passed his silent tomb. About 150 miles from Washington, the variegated and pleasant scenery of the Potomac is passed by entering the Chesapeake Bay. We had an experienced and skillful pilot, but his thirst for strong drink requiring the steward to fix him gin toddy and brandy sling so frequently awakened our fears for the safe navigation of the ship, so that we deemed it necessary to put him on an allowance of 3 glasses of grog per day, until he had piloted the ship outside of the Capes of Virginia. From the Capes of Virginia, we shaped our course east-southerly for Cape de Verde Islands, as is usual, to meet the northeast trade winds to carry us clear of the northeastern promontory of the Brazils or South America, down to the equator of the earth, where we meet the trade winds coming more southerly. In running down these northeast trades, one is struck with the brilliant pathway the ship keeps rolling up in her onward course during the darkness of the night. The light is so brilliant, I have been tempted to read by it at the midnight hour by holding my book open facing the shining track. But for the continual caving or tumbling of the sea to fill up the chasm under the stern of the ship, which blends the letters in the book, one could read common print by it in the darkest night. Someone who has examined this strange phenomenon tells us it is because the sea, particularly there, is filled with living animals or little shining fish called animalculae. Undoubtedly, these are food for larger fish. Further south, we meet with another species of slender fish about 1 foot long, furnished with little wings. All of a sudden, a large school of them rises out of the sea, wheel sometimes clear around and then drop into their element again. The cause of this, when seen sometimes, is a dolphin with all the colors of the rainbow, darting along like a streak of light in pursuit of his prey that has eluded his grasp by rising out of their element and taking an opposite course. In the night time they frequently fly on board the ship, affording the mariner a delicious breakfast. On our arrival off the capacious harbor and city of Rio Janeiro, we were struck with admiration while viewing the antique, cloud-capped, ragged mountains, and especially the towering sugar loaf that makes one side of the entrance to the harbor. Here we disposed of a large portion of our cargo and sailed for Montevideo at the entrance to the River La Plata. A few days before our arrival, we encountered a most terrific gale and storm, at the close of which we were drifting on to a rock-bound, uninhabited part of the coast. The wind died away to a dead calm, the sea and current setting us onto the rocks. Our only resort was to clinch our cables and drop our anchors. Fortunately for us, they held the ship. With my spyglass, I ascended the masthead to survey the rocky shore. After a while, I decided on the place, if we should break from our anchors and could get our ship headed for the shore, where we would plunge her, and if not overwhelmed with the surf, escape to the shore. After thus deciding, we made every necessary preparation, in case the wind should come on again in the night, to cut our cables and make a desperate effort to clear the rocks under our lee. After about 30 hours' anxious suspense, the wind began to rise again from the sea. We raised our anchors, and before midnight we considered ourselves out of danger from that quarter. Soon after this event we arrived at Montevideo, and disposed of the balance of our cargo and returned again to Rio Janeiro. I invested our funds in hides and coffee and cleared and sailed for Bahia or St. Salvador. On the Abrolhos banks we fell in with the ship Balena, Captain Gardner of New Bedford, trying out a sperm whale which they had harpooned the day before. Captain G was recently from New Bedford on a whaling voyage in the Pacific Ocean. After getting these huge monsters of the deep alongside of the ship, with sharp spades fitted on long poles, they chop off their heads, and with their long-handled ladles dip out the purest and best oil called head matter. Some of their heads yield 20 barrels of this rich product, which sells sometimes for $50 per barrel. Then, with their great iron blubber hooks, hooked into a strip of their blubber, to which the huge winding tackles are fastened, with the fall at the end of the windlass, the sailors heave it round while the spade men are cutting the strip down to the flesh. As the strip of blubber rises, the whale's carcass rolls over until the blubber is all on board the ship. The carcass is then turned adrift and soon devoured by sharks. The blubber is minced up into small pieces and thrown into large iron tripods and tried out. When the scraps are browned, they throw them under the tripod for fuel. The hot oil is then put into casks, cooled, coopered, and stowed away for a market. While this work is progressing, the cook and steward, if the captain thinks best, are at work to the flour barrels, rolling out bushels of doughnuts, which are soon cooked in the scalding oil as a general treat for all hands. Sailors call this having a good tuck-out. The hot oil is as sweet as new hog's lard. Captain Gardner furnished me with recent news from home and left letters with me for the States. In a few days I arrived at Bahia, and from thence sailed for Alexandria, D.C. While on our passage home I was seriously convicted in regard to an egregious error which I had committed in allowing myself, as I had done for more than a year, to drink ardent spirits, after I had practiced entire abstinence, because I had become disgusted with its debasing and demoralizing effects, and was well satisfied that drinking men were daily ruining themselves and moving with rapid strides to a drunkard's grave. Although I had taken measures to secure myself from the drunkard's path, by not allowing myself in any case whatever to drink but one glass of ardent spirits per day, which I most strictly adhered to, yet the strong desire for that one glass when coming to the dinner hour, the usual time for it, was stronger than my appetite for food, and I became alarmed for myself. While reflecting about this matter, I solemnly resolved that I would never drink another glass of ardent spirits while I lived. It is now about 46 years since that important era in the history of my life, and I have no knowledge of ever violating that vow, only in using it for medicinal purposes. This circumstance gave a new spring to my whole being and made me feel like a free man. Still, it was considered genteel to drink wine in genteel company. We had a pleasant passage from Bahia to the Capes of Virginia and arrived in Alexandria about the last of November, 1821. A letter was awaiting me here from my wife announcing the death of our only son. Mr. Gardner, the owner of the Talbot, was so well pleased with her profitable voyage that he purchased a fast-sailing brig and an assorted cargo in Baltimore for me to proceed in a trading voyage to the Pacific Ocean, while the Talbot remained in Alexandria to undergo some necessary repairs. While preparations were being made for our contemplated voyage, I took passage in the mail stage from Baltimore to Massachusetts to visit my family. We left Baltimore on Wednesday and arrived in Fairhaven, Massachusetts, on first day evening, after a tedious route of over 4 days, stopping nowhere only for a change of horses and a hasty meal until we reached Rhode Island. While passing through Connecticut in the night, the horses took fright and sheared on the side of a bank, upsetting the stage. a very heavy man on the seat with me, held to the strap until it gave way and fell upon me and crushed me through the side of the stage upon the frozen ground. If the driver had not leaped upon the bank as the stage was falling and stopped his horses, we must have been killed. It was some weeks before I fully recovered. Still, I rode on until I reached home. After remaining with my family a few weeks, on my return to Baltimore, as we were entering Philadelphia about midnight in a close winter coach, with one door and seven men passengers, as we were passing over a deep gully, the straps of the driver's seat gave way, and the two drivers fell under the wheels, unknown to us, who were snugly wrapped up inside. I asked why the horses were going with such speed. "I'll let them go," said another. "I like to go fast." I was not so well satisfied, but threw off my cloak, got the door open, and halloed to the driver. But receiving no answer and perceiving that the horses were going at full speed down Third Street, I reached around forward and found that the drivers were gone, and the lines trailing after the horses. I threw the step down, stepped out on it, perhaps a foot from the ground, and watched for an opportunity to jump on the snowbank, but the horses yet kept on the pavement where the snow was worn off. The passengers from behind were urging me to jump, as they wished to follow before the stage was dashed in pieces. I finally sprang forward with the going of the stage with all my strength, and just saw the hind wheels clearing my body when I pitched upon my head, and how many times I tumbled after that before I stopped I cannot tell. I found I had gashed the top of my head, from which the blood was fast flowing. I heard the stage rattling most furiously away down the street. By the aid of the moonlight, I found my hat and followed on after the stage. I soon came to Mr. G., my owner's son, who was in company with me from Boston. In his fright, he had jumped square out of the stage and was seriously injured. After getting him under a doctor's care, I started to learn the fate of the other five and our baggage. I met the horses with the driver, returning with the stage broken down on the wheels. Four other passengers followed our example and were not much injured. The last man out was a very heavy one, and he jumped out after the carriage left the pavement on the sand, uninjured. The horses ran to the river and turned suddenly under a low shed and crushed the stage upon the wheels, which would in all probability have killed every passenger that had dared to remain. We learned in the morning that the drivers but just escaped with their lives, the stage wheels crushing the fingers of one and taking a hat from the other's head. After a few days, we were enabled to proceed and arrived in Baltimore. Soon after my return to Baltimore, I was placed in command of the brig Chatsworth, with an assorted cargo suitable for our contemplated voyage, with unlimited power to continue trading as long as I could find business profitable. Firearms and ammunition were also furnished to defend ourselves in cases of piracy and mutiny. My brother F. was still my chief mate. We cleared for South America and the Pacific Ocean and sailed from Baltimore January 22, 1822. In a few weeks, we were passing Cape de Verde Islands, bending our course for the Southern Ocean. In the vicinity of the equator, in moderate weather and calms, we meet with a singular species of fish, more numerous than in higher latitudes, furnished with something analogous to oars and sails. Naturalists sometimes call them nautilus. They are a kind of shellfish. With their great long legs for oars to steady them, they rise and swell out above the water from 4 to 6 inches in length, and about the same in height, very much resembling a little ship under full white sail. They sail and sheer round about the ship, fall flat on the sea, as though they were upset by a squall of wind, rise erect again, and glide ahead with their accustomed speed, seemingly to show the mariner that they too are ships, and how they can outsail him. But as soon as the wind rises, their courage fails them, they take in all sail and hide under water until another calm. Sailors call them Portuguese men of war. About the 20th of March, we arrived and anchored in the harbor of Rio Janeiro. Finding no demand for the whole of our cargo, we sailed again for the River La Plata. As we approached the northern entrance of the river, in the stillness of the night, although some 3 miles from the shore, we could distinctly hear the sea dogs, or seals, growling and barking from the sand beach, where they had come up out of the sea to regale themselves. The next day we anchored off Montevideo to inquire into the state of the markets, and soon learned that our cargo was much wanted up the river at Buenos Aires. In navigating this, to us, new and narrow channel in the night without a pilot, we got on to the bottom and were obliged to lighten our vessel by throwing some of her cargo into the sea before we would float into the channel again. On our arrival at the city of Buenos Aires, our cargo sold immediately at a great profit. While lying at Buenos Aires, at the head of ship navigation, a heavy norther blew all the water out of the river for many leagues. It was singular to see officers and crews of ships passing from one to another, and to the city on hard, dry bottom, where but the day before their ships were floating and swinging to their anchors in 15 feet of water. But it was dangerous to travel many miles off, for the dying away of the wind or a change of wind at the mouth of the river rushed the water back like the roaring of the cataract and floated the ships in quick time again to swing to their anchors. Until the suppression of the Inquisition in 1820, no other religion but Roman Catholic was tolerated in Buenos Aires. It was singular to notice, as we had frequent opportunities to do so, with what superstitious awe the mass of the inhabitants regarded the ceremonies of their priests, especially the administering of the sacrament to the dying. The ringing of a small table bell in the street announces the coming of the host, generally in the following order. A little in advance of the priest may be seen a black boy making a ding-dong sound with his little bell, and sometimes two soldiers, one on each side of the priest, with their muskets shouldered, with fixed bayonets to enforce the church order for every knee to bow at the passing of the host, or subject themselves to the point of the soldier's bayonet. I was told that an Englishman, refusing to bend his knee when the host was passing him, was stabbed with the soldier's bayonet. Persons on horseback dismounted and kneel with men, women, and children in the streets, and at the threshold of their dwelling houses, groceries, and grog shops, while the host or the priest is passing with the wafer and the wine. We foreigners could stand at the four corners and witness the coming of the host, and pass another way before they reached us. Some 30 miles below the city of Buenos Aires is a good harbor for shipping, called Ensenado. To this place I repaired with the Chatsworth, and prepared her for a winter's voyage round Cape Horn.